If your day sounds like...
We need the report ASAP.
You deserve Modelo. If you've persevered through... You deserve this rich golden lager with a crisp but refreshing taste. Or if you overcame...
Two more.
You deserve this ice-cold reward. Modelo, the mark of a fighter. Drink responsibly. Beer imported by Crown Imports, Chicago, Illinois.
Hello and welcome to Baseball America's Draft Podcast. I'm Carlos Collazo, joined, as always, by Peter Flaherty. This is our first post-2024 draft podcast, though we are still 2 days away from the signing deadline. Peter, how are you doing, man?
Good. I'm fired up to be back. I was chomping at the bit to hop back on, so I'm excited we were able to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. It is always a bit tricky post-draft. There's a lot of stuff we have to do just on the website. There's typically a lot of travel involved. And then last week, I think, would have been a good opportunity to get on the show. But I was a bit sick, a little bit burnt out. So I think this will be a nice time to podcast, talk about the draft. We've had a little bit more time to kind of soak everything up and contextualize the draft a bit more. I believe as we record this podcast now, there are 8 players who I don't have assigned inside the top 10 rounds. One of those, Ryan Prager, it sounds like he's definitely not going to sign. He's going back to school. He's already announced that. I would imagine most of these other guys are going to sign. So it won't be an entirely like 100% finalized picture of the draft at this point, but I think enough of the heavy hitters have signed and we can make assumptions about a number of the other players who we expect to sign to have a fairly cohesive conversation just about the draft and how everything went. But Peter, one of the things that I mentioned kind of on draft night after the first round had taken place, just going down to the main desk on MLB Network and talking with those guys, was just the lack of surprises inside the first round. I really expected this year to be a lot more chaotic in the first round after the first 10 picks, but I don't know that there was like a shocking player who was taken in that range. I think the most obvious names that jump out is maybe a little bit surprising were guys like PJ Morlando and Braylon Payne for the Marlins and Brewers at 16 and 17. Then a little bit later on, Dante Norrie at number 27 to the Phillies. Those guys were all like the furthest off the board selections, but even then, all of them were in a range where we expected them to go on day one based on how these teams kind of picked with their next picks. I think it makes some sense why they targeted those players where they did. But yeah, I guess like what were your thoughts on how day one actually panned out based on what we were thinking? And I guess I kind of buried the lead here, but congratulations, your guy Travis Bazzana, you're 1-1 for really wire to wire here. He goes 1-1, so nice job. Next year maybe you can do the mock and it'll be a little bit better.
No shot it would be better, but yeah, it was a it was an interesting draft, like kind of how you said, it wasn't necessarily chalky like in terms of where guys went. There was some intrigue there. Kurtz at 4, Yesavage falling, I guess, to 20, Braden Montgomery being that odd man out of the top 10 that we kept referring to, as we went along through this cycle, as someone was going to be left out. We didn't know it was going to be Braden, but it just ended up being him. Yeah. But in terms of who went, other than a couple of the prep guys, like you said, you can throw Dante Norrie in there at 27 to the Phillies, I guess, to an extent, but there was no real stunning name that went on day one. I guess the one guy that I had as a little bit of a surprise was Emilian Petre, who went 58th overall to the Rays. It was a kind of a Rays-esque pick from an offensive profile. He's a hit tool first guy, could develop maybe a little bit into some power. But obviously you're betting on the hit tool here and that it's going to carry him through professional baseball. But it sounded like from the conversations that I know you had and I had on him, he wasn't going to last past like the third or the fourth, but I was surprised to see someone pull the trigger on him on night one. But outside of that, you know, there wasn't anything where I was sitting there, you know, kind of like jaw on the floor, like really surprised about who went where. Like I thought kind of, you know, like you said, all the names that should have gone went for the most part.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The other name that I'll mention just on day one that was maybe a little bit surprising was Arizona going with Ivan Luciano at number 64 with their second overall pick. At the time, I kind of wondered, is this like maybe a money-saving Puerto Rican pick in this range? We've seen teams go aggressive early with college seniors. I've talked to some teams who view the Puerto Rican prospects in general as maybe an area where you can save a little bit of money, but also get a younger player who maybe has a little bit more upside than is typical for a college senior saver. But the D-backs certainly don't view him in that lens. He signed for $990,000. So he was maybe the other name that we kind of had at the very back of the 500. He looked good at the draft combine. I'm not sure how much that draft combine specifically elevated his stock, but that was maybe the other surprising one. I think you're good to flag Petre. Who was the player who wasn't taken on day one that maybe surprised you the most, or that you would have, like, if you're running a team, you've been really excited to get him? Because there were a few names that I really expected to go day one, and granted, some of those guys went later and got paid commensurate with a day one bonus. But were there any players who stood out to you that just were still available as we were entering the third round in day two?
There were a few. All on the college side, you know, Drew Beam was one that I thought he was going to get snagged night one for sure. Cole Messina was another that I thought. And then even going a little bit further down, I guess to an extent, like Cincinnati getting Sirota with their third pick, 87th overall, I think that's outstanding value for getting someone like a Sirota. It sounded like as we approached the draft, he was going to be teetering on that late day one, early day two kind of gray area, and it ended up being that he went on day two. So I was a fan of that pick for the Reds. And then obviously two more. Dakota Jordan, I know, was a surprise. He didn't get selected until later on. I think everyone was probably sitting around and waiting for his name to get called, and relatively early, I think, on night one. Not saying it was going to be in the first round, but I think in the first half of night one wouldn't have been totally unreasonable if that's where he went. And then the last one was Austin Overn. I saw him a couple of times when I was on the Cape, and he was, you know, for my money's worth, when I saw him, he was the best player on the field. And I think for Baltimore to get him in the third round, it's interesting. You can, in two of their first three picks, you know, they go with Honeycutt at, I think it was
21.
I forget the number which they picked, but they get Honeycutt with their first pick.
22.
Gotcha. And Overn with their third. You know, they've got a couple of really high upside athletic outfielders to add to their already pretty deep system. So I was a fan of those, but those were the main guys that stood out to me. Did you have any others?
Yeah, I did. I think the Reds, I would name another player from their draft class, and that would be Luke Holman at 71. I just assumed that guys like Holman and Drew Beam, I think I would add to that grouping. Ryan Prager, I would add to that grouping. Maybe Daniel Egan. Like, some of these second-tier college players, I just expected to go in a good spot, since I thought that profile thinned out pretty quickly. So I think getting guys like Holman, Egan, Beam, Prager, if he would have signed, would have been nice. But maybe that's the reason that he should have gone a little bit earlier, just because the signability was day one signability potentially. So those were all names that I kind of expected. A lot of the high school players sliding down a little bit more is less surprising, just because you can pay them more easily with overslot bonuses. So those were the big ones. I mean, as soon as Dakota Jordan was available, I think he was the top ranked prospect we had available entering day two, I assumed someone was going to pay him overslot. Pretty nice on the Giants to get him through the third round again into the fourth and get him basically $2 million. We've got him at 1.9975. That's essentially the signing bonus contingency, where he'll get $2,500 after the contract gets executed. But for all intents and purposes, he got $2 million from the Giants. And I think it's a really creative draft strategy for San Francisco. They're picking in the first round at 13. They don't have another pick until the fourth round. They get a guy like James Tibbs, who you really love, at 13. I think that pick makes a lot of sense, just purely on value and in the range where I expected him to go. And then pairing it with another college player who's a top 40 prospect in this class reminds me of what the Rangers have done in the past when they have not had picks in the second and third round, just going for a really top heavy class and trying to acquire as good a talent as they can with their first two picks. I kind of like that strategy. It just seems a bit surprising that you land two arguably top or arguably first round talents while picking at 13 and 116. So I thought that was cool. Maybe my favorite pick of this draft, though, is JJ Weatherholt at 7. I mean, we have talked about Weatherholt versus Bizana versus Condon ad nauseum throughout the years over this podcast. He ranked number 3 on our final draft board. I mean, for me personally, I think he has a case as the best pure hitter in the class. One of the few players who are taken inside of the top, I'd say 15 picks, who has a real chance to stick at shortstop, depending on how you view guys like Connor Griffin, Seaver King. Maybe that changes in your mind. But for me, just seeing him picked at 7 when he went there, I was excited with that pick. I thought it was a really good spot for him. I thought you were getting a player who has a case for the number one player in the class at 7, like behind some guys like Nick Kurtz, Jack Caglione, Hagen Smith, who I think, I mean, I just would prefer Weatherholt over those guys. And then after seeing the bonus he signed for, $6.9 million for Weatherholt, that's just a steal to me. Like seeing that Chase Burns got 9.25, Condon 9.25, Travis Bazzano right at 9 million, Hagen Smith 8 million, Jack Caglione 7.5. Like I just think in terms of money and where he was picked, it just screams good value to me. I mean, I've said this in the past about Austin Martin going 5th to the Blue Jays in the 2022 or the 2020 draft, and maybe that one didn't pan out as good for me. But I just like that pick right now. I think it's a great value. I think it's a great player at 7. I think the Cardinals had to be thrilled just rarely picking this high and getting a player like JJ Weatherholt. But you do see maybe the implications of both Weatherholt and Nick Kurtz, the injuries. Like these were the two guys in this elite tier of college players inside our top 10 who got paid towards the bottom. It was Kurtz, Weatherholt, and then Brandon Montgomery, who slid outside of the 10 to 12 to the Red Sox. They all had the lowest bonuses. I mean, I wonder how much just the injuries that those guys dealt with impacted where they went and how much they signed for. But I think all three of these guys, I really like them just as much as players like Burns and Hagen Smith and Caglione, who were taken top 6 and got quite a bit more money. So I think any of the teams who wound up with I guess maybe outside of Oakland, their pick at Kurtz was a bit more strategic and a bit more of an underslot decision there to pass on some of those players and take Kurtz. But I really do think all these players are in a similar tier. So if you're getting them for that bonus amount, I think you have to feel good if you're a fan of the team.
Yeah, I mean, for what it's worth, I don't think it's worth much. But on my hashtag personal big board, Weatherholt was 2 behind Bazzano, and we're St. Louis, and you're not picking again until pick 80, you know, you kind of feel compelled to really try and hit a home run at pick number 7. And I think they hit a no doubter with Weatherholt. Like you said, the offense from an offensive standpoint, you can make an argument that, and I don't think you can even make an argument. I think you can say that he is the best pure hitter in the draft. There's some thump there. Like, I think he can go toe to toe with Bazzano almost from an offensive standpoint. And defensively, I think he fits best at second base, but he's a solid defender over there. And assuming his health holds up, he's an impact runner. Like he's a no doubt plus runner. He knows how to run. There is no shortage of tools here with him, and he's got potentially high impact big leaguer written all over him. And where he was able to kind of fall into their laps at 7, and you don't break the bank on him, like in like you said, $6.9 million is it's a tick over slot, but it's not the $9 million plus that a Chase Burns or a Charlie Conan got. So, I mean, you have to be, I think, thrilled with that. And I kind of like the Cardinals draft in general. Holiday with their second pick at 80. I know that it might come to a shock as to some people, but I really like him. He's a good athlete, 2 distinct break. Like, there are starter traits here. I think there's a little bit more velo in there as well. He's a really dynamic mover. Mm-hmm. You know, I like him a lot. Campos is another hit first catcher. The defense is solid. Braden Davis is another bulldog, little left-hander with a plus changeup, another guy with really little reliever risk. And then on day 3, I thought they knocked it out of the park again with guys like John Gazdar, Ian Petrutz. And the one guy, deep pull, but a guy to keep an eye on, is 16th round pick Daniil Ortiz from Walter State. He was committed to Tennessee. The track record at Walter State is excellent, unsurprisingly so to JUCO. But between 2 seasons in the Appy League and the Draft League, across 70 games, he's a career 320 hitter. nine doubles, 12 home runs, 16 bags, similar K walk. Like, I think there's something there with this kid. Mm-hmm. You know, and there's some thump and a semblance of a hit tool. And I think the fact that they were able to get him in the 16th and also sign him away from Tennessee, that's a big win as well. So I thought they did a great job.
Yeah, they seem to target a lot of players who just control the strike zone, both on the hitting side and the pitching side. Brian Holiday was one of the few players that we put a 60 control grade on him. That was a rare tool to get a 60 in this year's class, just considering how erratic a lot of the pitchers are. Guys like Weatherholt, Campos, John Gazdar really control the zone well, don't expand in their swing decisions. So it definitely seems to be a trait that the Cardinals prioritize. It's certainly a trait that I've thought of them targeting with their hitters, but a lot of their pitchers too, just really, really impressive ability to control the zone on the mound. Although it is maybe a little bit more of a hitter heavy draft class for them. One of the classes that I liked quite a bit is Colorado. I mean, this maybe is a fairly obvious one, just given the fact that they landed Charlie Condon, the number one player on our draft board, at number three. It's a great way to start off your draft class, I think. Also, just seeing the bonus that he signed for, $9.25 million, the same as Chase Burns. I mean, I view Chase Burns pretty highly in this draft class. I would have paid more money for Condon than Burns. So the fact that you get him for the same price makes it, in my mind, like a little bit stranger for Cincinnati's point of view. Like, I think you do take on a lot more risk with a guy like Burns at two compared to a player like Condon, just by nature of being a pitcher versus a hitter. So that one is maybe odd for them. But I think for the Rockies, you have to be excited about that, getting a bat like Condon's to play in Coors Field. I think Brody Brecht at 38 is significantly more exciting to me as your second pick and not a first-round pitcher. I feel like I've long talked about how I don't like Brody Brecht just based on where he was talked about going and thinking about him as a first rounder. But at pick 38, I think that's a phenomenal shot on his upside. And I think the risk reward proposition there as your second pick at 38th overall is much more appealing to me than if he was like the first guy you're taking in the 20s or even late teens. Jared Thomas in the second round, I think, is solid value. He's a good athlete. He's got a quality hit tool. I think he's probably going to be more regularly a center fielder in pro ball, and I think he's got the athleticism and speed and defensive instincts to play there well. You mentioned Cole Messina as a guy you expected to go on day one. I was right there with you. I certainly thought he was going to go in the second round. He didn't. He slides to the third round. I think in terms of like athleticism, defensive skill, power, arm strength, he really has a lot that you can like. He's coming off a phenomenal season. It's 3 years in the SEC. I mean, he might be one of the better defensive catchers in the class after Walker Yannick. I'm not sure exactly how high you would put him up there. It's a little bit more of an unorthodox defensive approach compared to some other catchers. It just looks a little bit different because he's so large, but he is a tremendous athlete, and he's started to put things together a little bit more consistently offensively. So I just think that profile overall, just given the tool set, given the position profile in the third round, like that's almost one of the more surprising picks to me who wound up sliding this far, given how the industry typically covets college catchers. I really like LeBaron Johnson. I've always been particularly high on him. I think maybe his pitch profile has a chance to play nicely in a field like Coors. It's a sinker profile. He attacks down in the zone. He needs to improve his command, but when he has been able to locate his fastball down, it's been a really effective pitch. Even looking at some of their day three arms, guys like Justin Lohr in the 13th round, Sam Gerth is a right-handed pitcher out of Navarro JC that, like, before the draft and after the draft, talking with some Texas scouts about him, he sounds really exciting. Luke Thelen in the 15th round. Like, I look down and I see the players they selected. They've signed their entire draft class. And the Rockies are actually one of the teams that has never not signed a top 10 rounder in the bonus pool era. So just kudos to them for nailing the signability. That's super key in the draft. But yeah, looking through their class, I really just like a lot of the guys they took, like a lot of the value they got. And again, you wind up with the number one player on the BA board at pick number three. I think you had to feel good about that.
Yeah, I mean, I thought they nailed it. And you brought up a ton of the points as to why I think they nailed it. Starting with Brody Brecht, if a team took Brecht with their first pick, I definitely wouldn't have been a fan of that. But the fact that the Rockies or whoever was going to get him, the fact that they got him with their second pick, I think there's a ton to be excited about. We don't need to keep, beating the drum on Brody Brecht. Everyone knows who he is at this point, but the stuff is outstanding, if the quality of strikes can improve and the pitchability can improve a little bit and they can unlock something with him, there's a chance that he ends up being a monster. Like, mm-hmm. from a stuff standpoint, he's the only arm in this draft that can even come close to matching Chase Burns. So,
yeah.
Great pick there. Jared Thomas at 42 was a guy that I really liked coming into this season. He unlocks some more power. He's a really good athlete who I think is going to be able to stick in center field long term, which is huge. And then, you know, going a little bit further down the board into deeper territory, Everett Catlett with their 12th round pick was a pick that I was a real fan of. 6'7" lefty. He had a good year this year at Georgetown, dominated the NECBL in 2023. Fastball up to a 6, kind of a low slot guy. Slider is really, really tough on left-handed hitters especially. And then changeup is still a little bit of a work in progress. You know, the pitch needs to progress. But I think it's a decent enough offering against right-handed hitters. So, I thought they did really well, with their drafting. And then I think similar to Cleveland with getting a guy like Bizzano with their first pick, getting Condon with their first pick also serves as a good anchor for how the draft class is going to be viewed as a whole. Like, whether it's the Rockies with Condon, Cleveland with Bizzano, some of these other teams getting, you know, high quality guys with their first pick. You know, it's a huge, potentially high impact big leaguer to build around. And I guess circling back to Cleveland, the fact they went with the Peter Flaherty special with Bizzano with their first pick, and then they got Braylon Doty, 36th overall. He was one of my favorite high school arms in the class, potentially my favorite in general, and they got him. So
you took him quite a few times. I think at least twice you took him in our staff drafts leading up in kind of like that top 30 range or just thereafter. So that makes sense that you like this draft in the first two. And I really like, I guess it feels odd that we're 20 minutes into a draft podcast and we're only now talking about Cleveland extensively, just given that they picked one, their huge bonus pool. But I really think that this draft makes a ton of sense for Cleveland, what they've done historically, the player profiles they've targeted for the strengths and weaknesses of this draft class. I like the fact, like, it seemed like regardless of who they were taking, they were going to save money on that player at number one. It's just a matter of who that player was going to be. They saved $1.6 million with Bizzano signing for just under $9 million there with a 10.5 slot valuation. And they loaded up on high upside high school pitchers. You mentioned Doty. They took Joey Okey in third. He signed for $2 million. Doty signed for 2.6, just under there. Cameron Sullivan, as we record this, still not signed. I would expect him to be signed. Chase Mobley in the 10th round, 1.8 million. So they got four players who we viewed as top five round talents. Three of those guys, top 100 talents. Just super high upside preps that I think you have to feel good about all these profiles in a Cleveland system that has done well with pitching. Travis Bizzano signed very early. He's already in affiliated ball. I think he's already started playing at this point. I would expect him to be a quick mover and just a very polished, well-rounded player. You also have guys like Jacob Cozart in the second round. We've talked about Jacob Cozart a lot on this podcast. I'm maybe a little bit higher on him than you are, but I think we both probably like the value at 48, just given the tool set, the power from the left side, and the chance to stick at catcher. That's a lot more appealing in the second round than like late first, where he was at various points in this season. I like Aiden Major for them in the fifth round out of West Virginia. I think he does a lot of things pretty well. It'd be interesting to see if they can get him throw a little bit more strikes in the future. But I just think in general, like getting a guy like Bizzano, signing him for significantly cheaper, maybe not significantly, but notably cheaper than the other players who are going around him when he's an equivalent talent, and then just targeting a ton of these high upside high school pitchers, which is really a strength of the depth of the high school class, I think is exactly what you wanted to see them do.
Yeah, and from a development pairing standpoint, it makes a lot of these picks more fun, like you alluded to with Okey and Aiden Major. Rafe Schlesinger was another guy that I thought was a really fun pick and a good pick for them in the fourth round. Low slot lefty up to 96, ton of run and ride through the zone, long and sweepier slider. It's a borderline plus pitch, if not an already plus pitch, and the changeup continues to really develop. So I think getting him in the fourth round is a really good pick. He's a little bit in the mold of a Carson Palmquist, also a former Miami left-hander, ironically enough, drafted by Colorado a few years back. I think he's actually better than Palmquist was, even if Palmquist was more dominant and had some more juice coming into the draft. I think I'd take Schlesinger over Palmquist. And then Donovan Zach and Sean Mattson in the eighth and ninth rounds, respectively. Donovan Zach is a really interesting pick, at least for me. Health track record is not the greatest. I think he's a double TJ guy, but he's finally healthy this year. Explosive fastball up to 98 and 99. Like, it's a really kind of high effort, full board delivery, but the stuff is really interesting. I caught him really good on the Cape. I think he's a reliever, but I think he can be like a high leverage type reliever. And Sean Mattson is in a similar mold, throwing 89 to 92 mile an hour invisiballs. Changeup is without a doubt a plus pitch, borderline double plus. I think I took his changeup in our like build a pitcher podcast, which is really fun. I actually can't wait to do it again like this fall for the 25 draft. Mm-hmm. But those two guys, 8 and 9, potentially high impact reliever types. Fan of those picks. And then you go deep, deep, deep into day three. They got Cam Schulke in the 19th. Kind of became like I'll phrase this like kind of lightly, but like a Twitter couch scout like favorite in the off season leading into the 24 season, because they discovered that he threw from like multiple slots and all this, and he was really good on the Cape League, and he is kind of a one of one profile, and that he is I think he's the one multi-slot, like true multi-slot guy in the draft. He'll go from high three quarters, sidearm, and true subby. So that's I think an excellent flyer to take, give him, you know, 55,000, whatever they gave him in the 19th, and roll with it. Cause I think his stuff really does play against wood bats. So we'll see how far it can take him. But again, a fan of this draft in general, it's hard for me not to be a big fan of it. Mm-hmm. Given they got Bazzana at one, but a lot of these other picks to supplement it, like Doty, Schlesinger, Aiden Major, Zach Mattson, mm-hmm. Even Garrett Howe, mid-major banger they got in the 11th. Like, there's a lot to like, both from who they got and then also who they're bringing them in to develop with. Like, their player development system is outstanding, so they're going to maximize all these guys' tools, and they could have a couple of monsters in here.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search. Match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging. You can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. I think we're going to have an opening coming open. When it comes open, I'm going to use Indeed. Why? Because Indeed makes my job easy. When I'm hiring, it puts it all in one place. It organizes it. It does the thinking for me to where I can just connect with quality candidates and do the process that we need to do to hire. That's what Indeed does. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Baseball America. Just go to Indeed.com/Baseball America right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/Baseball America. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. The heat of summer is here. Whether you're going for a long run or just sitting by the pool, your favorite summer treat could be giving you extraordinary hydration. Liquid IV has refreshing summer flavors like Popsicle Firecracker and Rainbow Sherbet that hit the spot when you need transformative, hydrating relief all summer long. Indulge in hydration with electrolytes, essential vitamins, and clinically tested nutrients from the number one powdered hydration brand in America, Liquid IV. Did you know that blue and pink cotton candy are different flavors? I didn't until I started enjoying both of them through Liquid IV. Personally, I'm partial to the blue cotton candy. I make sure I pour some in my water bottle with some ice before I head out on a bike ride. It not only hydrates, but it's a more enjoyable way to stay hydrated. Blue cotton candy, that's my recommendation. But I've yet to find a Liquid IV flavor I don't like. Cool off your summer with the reimagined flavors of treats like Rainbow Sherbet and Popsicle Firecracker. Or make your own Liquid IV popsicles. Indulgent flavors keep your wellness rituals fresh and keep you motivated and hydrated. Find all your favorite flavors on the website. There's acai berry, lemon lime, pina colada. You can even choose from their line of sugar-free flavors like raspberry melon, white peach, and green grape. The white peach, that's pretty good too. Tear, pour, live more. One stick and 16 ounces of water hydrates better than water alone. It's powdered by Live Hydroscience, an optimized ratio of electrolytes, essential vitamins, and clinically tested nutrients that turn ordinary water into extraordinary hydration. Three times the electrolytes of the leading sports drink, eight essential vitamins and nutrients. Always non-GMO, vegan, gluten-free, dairy-free, and soy-free. Indulge in hydration this summer with Liquid IV. Get 20% off your first order of Liquid IV when you go to liquidiv.com and use code BA2022 at checkout. That's 20% off your first order when you shop Better Hydration today using promo code BA2022 at liquidiv.com.
Do you have any draft classes that you kind of look at and you wonder about them, or maybe you're less excited or a little confused about, or just outright don't like them as much? You can kind of jump into any of those that you want. I know I do think it is tricky on draft day to just come out and say, like, this is a bad draft class versus this is a good draft class, just because, I mean, realistically, we don't know until 5, maybe 10 years from now. We won't truly know. So it is tough to just bag on a draft entirely, because, again, with a lot of the players too, I'm thinking about the Padres specifically. Like,
you took the words out of my mouth.
No, not that I don't like them, but, like, with a specific pick, with Cobb Hightower in the third, like, this is a pick where I could say, oh, we didn't have him ranked. He wasn't on the 500. Why are you taking him in the third round? But quite honestly, like, a lot of times when teams take players like this, it's because we're simply less knowledgeable about the player. Like, Evan Carter was one of the biggest surprise picks that we've seen. And it turns out the Rangers just knew he was better than what we all thought. Like, that might be the case with Cobb Hightower. But the draft I always come back to, I feel like for several years now, I just don't like my perception of their strategy. But the Angels, maybe it's also easier to say knowing that they're not signing Ryan Prager, but Christian Moore at 8, like, when you have guys like Brandon Montgomery and Bryce Rainer and Siever King still on the board, and you're passing on those guys to take a guy like Christian Moore, who I think is solid, but I mean, you're saving a lot of money there at number 8 overall, and you're putting it towards players further down in the draft. And I do like getting Trey Gregory Alford to sign for basically $2 million in the 11th round. I love that pick as an upside selection. And the fact that they did take Ryan Prager in the third round and didn't sign him, I think it doesn't hurt your draft class in the same way that, like, not signing Kumar Rocker really hurt the Mets in their draft class a few years ago. But guys like Chris Cortez is a second rounder. I like Chris Cortez quite a bit. I think he's elite stuff, but I view him more as a third round talent. I think Ryan Johnson is fine at the second comp pick at 74. That's fine on value, but, like, Ryan Johnson is just a player profile that I was always going to be less excited about him, just given my concerns about the reliever, about the delivery. Like, I do think they have some interesting arms here. Dylan Jordan, Bridger Holmes, Derek Clark are all kind of intriguing guys for various reasons on day two. I just think it's a lot of pitching that has a lot of reliever risk throughout the first 10 rounds, and I think Christian Moore is a good player, but I think the Angels passed on better players to save money on Christian Moore to kind of layer throughout the draft in a way that maybe is not as exciting to me as, like, the Guardians getting someone who I view as a great talent with their options available. I it's tough for me with the Angels draft class, and we'll see what happens with them. But that was one that jumps out as confusing. I got a couple others, but I'll let you go ahead and go.
Yeah, I mean, the Angels to me also stand out again, and Cortez was where I was going to lead. I really liked Chris Cortez coming into the draft. You know, you saw him really good in Omaha and throughout the spring, like, really dynamic reliever, but I'm not taking a reliever 45th overall, even as good as Chris Cortez is, as good as Chris Cortez probably will be in a major league bullpen, and with how the Angels are operating with their guys, like, he could be pitching for them in September. I say that kind of facetiously. I'd be shocked if that's the case, but again, like, I'm not taking that 45th overall, and it feels like in the top 10 round, like, I don't it's hard to get excited about a lot. Like Ryan Johnson, I think getting him in the, as I think it was the last pick on night one, I think that's a solid get, especially where you're getting Ryan Johnson. He was another one where if he didn't go on day one, I would have brought up in the, like, guys you're surprised didn't go on day one portion of the show. So I think that was a solid pick for him. Interesting east-west profile, fastball shape still you need to refine. So we'll see if their player development department is up for the challenge. But outside of that, like, on day two, like, I like Bridger Holmes a lot, but the fact that Bridger Holmes, who's a submarine sidearm reliever, now that Brian Prager isn't signed, is probably the pick I'm most excited about on day two in someone's class is like, probably not like the greatest sign. Like all these guys now that I'm saying this are going to pan out and it's their upside, and like Bridger Holmes will be the like supplemental guy. But the fact that right now he's the guy I'm most excited about, and he's a good arm, but it's an interesting, I don't really know what they were going for here. Like Peyton Olenek in the sixth is an interesting flyer, obviously an outlier build, 6'11", 200 pounds, interesting stuff. Like there's probably some really intriguing data under the hood as well from a release height and extension standpoint, but Randy Flores in the eighth, Derek Clark in the ninth, and Ryan Nicholson in the 10th. Just kind of older. And granted,
they all did sign for 1,000. So
that, I mean, that is true. So like, if you're just going to give those guys
clearly saving some money there for Gregory Alford.
Right. So I guess like even from a money saver perspective, those, I'm with you on the Angels.
And I'll say this, like, it just seems like the Angels continue to prioritize fast movers, and like a guy like Ben Joyce, I think, is a good example. I wasn't really thrilled with the Ben Joyce pick in the third round when they took him in 2022. He has been better in the big leagues than I expected him to be. I still think that probably, like, given the strikeout and walk rates, I would be curious to see how he does moving forward. I don't think he's going to pitch like to the 2.0 ERA he has so far moving forward. But that pick, it has been better than I thought. But in general, I just think a lot of these pitchers they're taking are just fast moving bullpen types. And I just wish, I think we said it last year, like we were wondering where the impact was in the Angels draft class. I wish they hunted for that a little bit more. And maybe it's just like a personal, like personal biases with me, profiles that I like a willingness to take on the high school profiles, like a little bit more, just shooting for a little bit more upside that maybe will take a little bit longer is something that always compels me. I do think Christian Moore has a little bit more impact potential at eight than a guy like Nolan Shanuel. Like, I like their first pick better than Nolan Shanuel last year, but I also just still have some concerns about Christian Moore's pure hitting ability and swing and miss concerns. I think there's a little bit of maybe Chase Davis in Christian Moore's profile, where for the first 2 years of his college career, there are real contact questions. He addressed them as a junior. Does that mean those contact questions are gone moving forward, that he is like wholly a different hitter and is not going to swing and miss moving forward? Like, I'm not so sure that's the case. I think there are still some like defensive questions I have with him as well. And just so like, when I don't love the players they passed on at one, and then I don't also love some of the next pitchers they took, I guess given that strategy to save money with the first pick, it's just hard to like get really excited about it for me personally. Again, this draft class could wind up just being a lot better than I think. But as we sit here today, I think I'd rather have Brandon Montgomery at eight.
Oh, 1,000%. And I think the fact that the Sox got him at 12 and they even signed him under slot is a huge coup. So kudos to them. But I'm with you all the way on the Angels. And even with some of these fast moving relievers, like I personally don't understand, like, again, circling back to Cortez with your second pick, like, again, stuff is really good. He's got the upside to be one of these high impact relievers at the big league level. But on a larger scale, like, these guys can only, like, you want to give the ball to them, you know, to close, like, when you have the lead. Like, it's a bigger issue with the Angels, but again, like, these guys can only be so effective on a poor team at the major league level. So again, just an interesting draft in general, but there were just surprising picks up and down their board.
You have any other team that maybe jumps out to you? I've got one other one that I can mention, but if you have another one, I'll let you go, since I kind of drove the ship on the Angels.
I'll let you lead the way on this one again. I'm curious where you go.
Yeah, I would just point out Milwaukee as another team, like Breland Payne at 17. Clearly, there was a strategy here to save money with Payne at 17. Maybe they really liked him and didn't think he would make it to one of their next few picks. They signed him for $3.4 million at 17 overall, saved basically $1 million on him. Then they went over slot for Bryce Message in the second round. They also went over slot for, who else did they put some money towards? I guess slightly. No, that was kind of their one big overslot deal. I guess Chris Lavonis has to be the other one. He's not signed yet as we record this draft class, but that has to be the other area where all the money is going to in this draft. But Breland Payne just seemed out of place as a first rounder, more so to me than PJ Morlando. Just given my thoughts on, like, I was probably personally higher than the industry on PJ Morlando and probably lower than the industry on Breland Payne. So that might explain some of the, like, the differences here and how I think about Payne and Morlando in the same spot in the middle of the first round. I just have concerns about, like, how much impact you're getting from an offensive profile here. He is very fast. Like, he's a 70 grade runner. I think just given that speed alone, he's got a chance to be a solid defensive outfielder, but I just think there are a lot of things you need to do to maximize Payne's tool set moving forward. There are still some things directionally with the swing I think need to improve. I mean, he's athletic, he's young for the class. It clearly is important for a team like the Brewers, but I just think there are a lot of players that I would have rather had with the first round pick. And then, like, I do like Bryce Message and Chris Lavonis reasonably well, but I don't know if I think that taking a guy like Breland Payne as your money saver to secure those guys makes me super thrilled with the entire package. I do like Blake Burke, but he's also taken towards, like, maybe the top of the range that I would have been happy taking him. He's a pretty limited bat-only profile. I do think that he improved some the contact questions in a similar way that Christian Moore did at Tennessee. Their lineup really was firing on all cylinders this year, and you saw Tennessee get rewarded on draft day. But it's just like there's not a pick that I can look at here and I'm like, wow, I really like this value here. And I just have maybe some question marks about where some of the players went versus where I would maybe take them. So maybe some question marks about Milwaukee's.
Yeah, I agree. And Payne, it's clear Payne was their guy, but I wonder if, you know, I find it hard to imagine. Maybe this wouldn't have been the case. Maybe someone would have pounced on him, but I would be surprised if he wasn't around at their second pick, but maybe they didn't even want to run the risk of that being the case. And I'm with you, mm-hmm. The fact that where they saved over $1 million on him and diluted that to Bryce Message and presumably a little bit of it to Chris Lavonis from some of these other guys that they were able to save some money on. I'm with you where, like, those guys don't necessarily get me super fired up. Lavonis certainly more so than Message, like, mm-hmm. Tons of stuff with Lavonis, sick athlete, really dynamic mover. You can, you know, there's a ton of upside here with him. And I also think from a developmental standpoint, like, the Brewers are becoming one of these teams to watch in the draft, especially with the arms that they take. Mm-hmm. Because I think that there are a lot of fun developmental pairings, and in looking up and down their board, I'd like, there are a handful of those guys. I'm with you that it is a little bit of an interesting class in general. Blake Burke was a guy that coming into the draft, I was kind of, you know, beating the drum on, and someone I was really excited about, and I would have without a doubt taken him on day one. But I'm with you that 34th overall was towards probably, like, that was probably the highest that I would have taken him. Mm-hmm. I think he would have been more back half of the day for me. And then leading off day two with Jerome DeBerry, that's another, like, Brewers development. Like, that's a fun pairing, I think. Mm-hmm. But then Marco Dinges in the fourth was a real surprising pick for me. I thought with Dinges, like, there was a non-zero chance that he was even going to be able to go back to school in Tallahassee. So to see him go off the board in the fourth and for not, like, an extremely underslot deal, that was really surprising to me. Like, he's a bat first DH type of guy, so mm-hmm. You know, I like the bat. He's a really strong physical kid with all fields power and physical freak. The approach took a little bit of a step forward this year and was better than I thought it would be at Florida State, but in the fourth round, that's an interesting spot for him.
Yeah. Well, let's not end this on too much of a downer, Peter. I want to circle back to another class that as I look at it, I kind of like find myself appreciating more and more, and that's the Nationals. They took Siver King 10th overall, and I think on draft night when this pick was made, this was maybe the first player that I was surprised to hear their name called. Everyone up to this point made sense to me, both in terms of like my understanding of teams' interest in those players, my expectations of the range players would go. I knew that the Nationals had cast a fairly wide net, but I kind of had just kept coming down to the fact that like there's a tier of 10 players. I expect them to take one of those guys. You have Bryce Rainer available. You had Brayden Montgomery available still. And so Siver King's name was called. A little bit surprising for me at the time, just given some of those other players who were available. But I think when you look at what he signed for and then who they were able to get with their next pick, getting Siver King and Caleb Lomavita at 10 and 39, like the fact that the Nationals got Caleb Lomavita with the 39th pick, I think is a massive win for them. So we had Siver King ranked 17th. We had Caleb Lomavita ranked 18th. So again, two like solid top 20 players in a class, definite first round talents when you're picking 10 and 39. I think that's great. Caleb Lomavita kept sliding throughout the first round. And as he was slipping, I was like, okay, he's clearly going to one of these teams who has multiple picks, who can give him an overslot bonus, give him a lot of money. But then he signs for $2.3 million, and both Walker Yannick and Malcolm Moore signed for $3 million. Like, we talked a lot about how we line up these college catchers. I prefer Lomavita to Malcolm Moore. I maybe prefer Yannick to Lomavita, but not at a difference that's $700,000 worth. So I just think that getting those two is a really exciting way to start off your draft. Then you get a guy in Luke Dickerson, who signs for $3.8 million at pick 44 in the second round. Dickerson is a guy that had a lot of chatter throughout the first round. I think he goes here in a good spot on talent. I think in like the middle of the first round, I think it's a lot of risk maybe for a player like Luke Dickerson, but I do like the athlete. I like the tool set. I like the profile. I like the upside potential as your second round pick and as the third player overall that you've taken. I like that quite a bit. Kevin Basil, Jackson Kent with their next picks in the third and fourth round are interesting to me. But really, this draft is squarely on the first three picks. I think the Nationals got a lot of talent in those picks. And then just kind of scanning down at some of the other players, like Sir Jameson Jones in the 15th round for $500,000. I think there are some questions about how he moves and like the pure hit tool and if he's going to stick behind the plate. But I would like to take a shot on that sort of upside, physicality, power, potential in the 15th round. So this is a draft that really, I find myself liking the more I look at it.
Yeah, the first three picks, you hit the nail on the head. It's talent and tools, and I think that, you know, Lomavita is the guy that I've long liked, and Dickerson was one of the bigger helium guys throughout the cycle, especially in the Northeast. And like you said, in the late in the first round where he was getting some chatter would have been a little too rich for me, but where the Nationals were able to get him in the second and with their third overall pick, I think that's an outstanding spot for him. Mm. Siver King has been a famous name really since opening weekend. It's just tools on tools on tools. And then, you know, if you can get the hit tool to click a little bit and the pitch recognition skills to progress, you let him run around in center field. Like, there's a ton of upside there with King. I'm with you, though, that I was a little surprised to hear him go at 10. I thought it would have been a little further down in the teens, but it's clear the Nats were all in on him and didn't want to let him get past them. So mm-hmm. I like that. And then even further down their board, like, it doesn't stop there with guys that I like that they took. Robert Kranz, one of the more underrated yet impressive relievers, the college level fastball is a plus pitch, supplements it with another plus breaking ball. Like, that's a fast moving reliever type. Sam Peterson is a guy that I really liked and came to like last summer, outfielder out of Iowa. There's another intriguing combination of performance and tools. Day three, a deep, deep sleeper in their class is Nolan Hughes from Xavier. And if you just look up Nolan Hughes on Baseball Reference or Xavier's website, nothing on the back of his baseball card is going to blow you away. Like, the command right now and control is like it's a 30, and that might be like being nice, but from a stuff standpoint, it is extremely, extremely loud. 6'5 left-hander on the Cape last summer when I saw him, and you look at his Cape stats, it was like an 8+ ERA with I think 15 walks and 6 2/3 innings. But from a stuff standpoint, he was unmatched. So if they can get the strike throwing ability to take even just a little bit of a step forward. They're like, there's a ton to like under the hood with Hughes. And
how dissimilar is this pick from the Cubs taking Daniel Brown out of Campbell in the 16th round a year ago?
That's a great comp.
Is the control, it does seem like the control is at least marginally better for Hughes.
Yeah. If we want to really
Brown might be one of the worst pure control pitchers that I've seen like get taken in this range. So
yeah, if we want to get down to the nitty gritty with Brown's control being a 20, we'll give Hughes like a 25. So like you can stick Hughes on the mound. Like Xavier was able to stick Hughes on the mound and like he was able to get outs. So that's where he's got him beat. But it's a fun flyer that like I would gladly give him 150K. I was actually surprised he didn't go last year. Kind of in a similar range, 150, just take a flyer on him. Hope you can unlock the strike throwing. And then in the 14th, Yoel Tejeda is another interesting arm. So this is a really fun class, I think, top to bottom, and a lot of guys to like.
Yeah, no, it's a good one. All right. Any other classes that you like, dislike, any other players that you want to mention as surprises, good values? I think that's kind of the big ones that I wanted to hit on this podcast. But again, signing deadline is this week. We'll have that to talk about once we kind of have the final numbers on everything. We can maybe talk through best values at that point, like look into strategically how teams decided to use their bonus pool. Got into a little bit of that today, but that's always an interesting element of the draft. We also have East Coast Pro coming up, some other summer showcases. You've been on the Cape, so we'll be able to pivot to 2025 fully at some point in the near future. But yeah, before we get out of here, any other players that you want to mention, go ahead.
I think we talked about everything that interested me, at least on night one of the draft and all the classes we hit on. Yankees clearly had a plan going college pitching heavy. And a lot of guys who ironically enough performed well in the Cape. Thatcher Hurd, I saw his last start before he left the Cape, and it was like the Thatcher Hurd that everyone was waiting to see, I feel like, for his entire college career. Like,
yeah.
Everything.
Hurd is a guy who just has every like trait you want to see in a pitcher. You see it on the mound with the athleticism, the physicality, the delivery, the pure stuff, and it's just like he's never been able to kind of fully put it together over a consistent period of time. And if a pro team is going to unlock some of that, I think he's got a ton of upside. First time the Yankees have drafted a pitcher with their first pick since 2017 and Clark Schmidt as well. So that was kind of cool.
Oh, good call there. And with Hurd in that last start, like everything he did, like from his pregame bullpen to what he actually did, it was big league. Like, just it was different, like looking at him on the mound than it was other guys. And it's a dynamic pitch mix. There's a chance for potentially 3+ pitches in there. And ironically enough, the pitch that I might most be excited about in his arsenal is his high 80s, low 90s cutter. Like that was really, really working for him in that outing. And then he mixes in that high spin breaking ball that's just outstanding when it's on, and the fastball was up to 95-96 and he was holding it through 5 innings, just attacking guys. The mound presence was excellent, and I think, you know, getting him with they might have even been a little surprised that he was still on the board at 89 overall. I kind of was, and was sort of half expecting him to go late on day one, but I know that's a guy that they're really, really fired up about.
Yeah, no doubt. I think that's a good call. Cool. Well, Peter, anything you want to plug before we get out of here on today's show?
Yeah. So even with the draft coming to an end, there's a ton of stuff that, you know, I'll be putting out and everyone else will be putting out on the site. I think right now, though, the stuff you should be focused on is on baseballamerica.com is all of the trade deadline analysis. Everyone has been beyond crushing it with trade analysis and reaction and updating the 30s, and like if you want the most up-to-date and now like anything that you want, it's all up-to-date on baseballamerica.com as far as the trade deadline goes, your favorite team, your favorite prospects, where they stand now. Mm-hmm. It's all up there, and then there's a ton of 2025 draft stuff coming, and a little bit further down the road, early in the fall, there'll be college recruiting class rankings and transfer portal winners and losers. So hopefully, whatever you're interested in, there is a lot of stuff up on the site.
Yeah, absolutely. Well said. JJ and Jeff and Josh have really been grinding on the prospect side. So if you are into all that stuff this week, that definitely check out all their coverage. There's been podcasts on the BA feed focused on the trade deadline. If you want that, you can get it there. So for Peter, I'm Carlos. Thank you guys for joining us, everyone. We will see you next time.